Hey, it's Michael, and just before we get into this episode of The Strategy Report, I just wanted to let you know that there's an all-new version of the Formula Legend mobile game available for iOS and for Android. It's the perfect mobile racing companion for the home, for the train, for the office, operating theatre, literally anywhere you can think of, you should have this game with you. So if you go to formulalegend.beermogul.com, you can find out more information and download your first copy or upgrade your copy of the Formula Legend mobile game. Hello and welcome to the F1 Strategy Report for Formula Legend. On this week's edition, the Canadian Grand Prix, why can't anyone other than Mercedes win a race? And is Pirelli wasting costs on shipping for the ultra-soft tyre? That's all to come on this edition of the Strategy Report. And my guest this week for the Canadian Grand Prix, possibly the first time of the year, granted we've been to some obscure places, that I actually have a man from the country itself. His name's Ernie Black. You might know him as the F1 poet on Twitter. Ernie, how are you?
I'm fantastic. Thanks, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing very, very well. Now that we've recovered all those humble viewers from Australia from the frankly horrific time zone of the Canadian Grand Prix. But it's always worth it, Canada. I don't think anyone actually has any gripes, other than perhaps Bernie Eccleston, but that's largely for money reasons, over the Canadian Grand Prix. It really is one of those special events on the calendar, isn't it?
Absolutely. The city lends itself to Formula One. And the experience at the circuit, as well as the city, is fantastic. I've been to several Grand Prix, and you really feel the atmosphere.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting how much the atmosphere of a race really plays into our standing of it, even for those who will never get to the race. I mean, we've got some great tracks in some obscure places where Formula One's maybe not a huge deal, but it's always nice to go back to what I suppose we can call the European heartland, or American heartland even, where the crowd is really big, and it almost doesn't matter what happens in the race after that because everyone just has a good time.
Yeah, I think pretty much everyone starts drinking around Thursday, and by Monday they can hardly remember who won the race.
We're more than happy to fill them in on that. All they need to do is subscribe, and it's that straightforward. The weather, though, I want to talk about the weather, because we normally do have to talk about the weather in Canada. It tends to be one of those races, and it did play a significant part, or so it seems. But it didn't ever rain. It was all just about the fact it was kind of cold.
Yeah, with Montreal, you never do know what the weather holds. There's no such thing as predicting the weather in Montreal. Let's face it, the circuit is on a man-made island in the middle of the St. Lawrence Seaway, and it has, much like Melbourne, it has the possibility of having all four seasons in the same day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And we sort of saw, at least across the 3 days, we had some quite warm weather on Friday, or some, let's say, reasonable racing weather on Friday, and it cooled right down by Sunday, to the point where some of that tyre data the teams will have learned on free practice during Friday was kind of irrelevant, to the point where it was a little bit of an unknown regarding the duration of the tyres, the pace they would ultimately hold. So we saw a lot of people playing a little bit conservatively with the tyres, but we'll get into the race strategy in just a moment, because I want to go back to qualifying. This is, of course, what set up the entire weekend, because compared to the last couple of years, where Mercedes, with undoubtedly the class-leading engine and even the class-leading car, let's face it, in the last two seasons, usually dominated here by around 0.7 of a second in qualifying over the next closest car, none of the sort in Canada. And it seems like Ferrari and even Red Bull Racing, with their Renault engine, for the so maligned Renault engine, has really caught right back up.
Yeah, I think Ferrari definitely made a step forward with their new turbo, as we saw in Seb's car. And let's face it, Daniel's pretty much quick anywhere he goes, especially with that Red Bull chassis, even without their power. But Renault's also made some gains, so I'm glad to see that we're seeing a trend where the gap is starting to tighten, so that we might actually see some scraps on the track, and maybe even people stealing points from each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really puts into context, without getting into the last two race results, I suppose, the fight Nico Rosberg is going to have on his hands to maintain this championship, regardless of the fact that his points lead's now been slashed to 9 from 43.
Wow.
After the Russian Grand Prix, I think it was, which, yeah, really puts it into perspective. But the fact now, I mean, it could help or hinder him, I suppose, that Lewis Hamilton is not necessarily his chief rival anymore. Perhaps he's the chief rival, but there'll be other drivers looking to take victories and points away from perhaps either of them. So it really does set up, going into the second third of this season, a pretty interesting power balance.
Absolutely. If we look at, let's take one step back and say that the game, the head game, is very important. And right now, Lewis has the lead. He has the edge on a Nico who's lost that ever so important confidence that he might have had. You saw him fight back desperately in the race, but Lewis is definitely on top of his game right now. He feels that he's mentally strong. He's got the momentum, and he smells blood. On top of that, we've got everybody else that's starting to pick up their game. So if Nico loses a few points here and a few points there, you can easily see Lewis catch up without necessarily having to beat Nico.
Mm-hmm. And we might end up in a situation where Nico Rosberg has lost that opportunity to take a title in the class-leading car, the opportunity Lewis Hamilton had for the first 2 years. And it becomes a much broader, I guess, psychological fight. And another which Rosberg hasn't had experience in. I mean, Lewis Hamilton obviously knows what it's like to have a multi-way championship battle. And I think a lot of that sort of played into his experience fighting for championships. In any case, the way he was able to really smash Rosberg out of the park last season. But this year, it's a different battle completely. Rosberg now knows what it's like to go toe-to-toe with a single driver. But what's it going to be like when you've got to compete with, like, Sebastian Vettel, a four-time world champion, or even Daniel Ricciardo, who's a bit of an unknown quantity himself in a championship fight?
Absolutely. One thing that we did notice is that the Mercedes does not like being in dirty air. It really doesn't handle the same way. So if you get stuck behind some traffic, it could really impact your race. And if Nico finds himself in that position again, he's going to struggle.
Absolutely. And that plays fantastically well into exactly what we saw during the Grand Prix, because it wasn't Lewis Hamilton and Nico Rosberg leading away from the first row off the line. It was Sebastian Vettel who qualified in third place, who led them round the first corner after, I think, Maurizio Riverbene described as the best start ever in Formula One. I couldn't say that objectively, but I can say that it was a very, very good start, enough to beat Hamilton. Rosberg got a better start than Hamilton as well, but he was pushed out of the way at the first turn. I guess, first of all, before we get into the strategy of it, what was your take on that first turn move, which proved so decisive for Rosberg's race?
I don't know what they fed Vettel before the race, but boy, did he he jumped out of the rabbit hole like he had dynamite up his ass. He was just on fire. And looking back, I don't know if I should blame him or Lewis for Daniel's poor, race, because Rosberg ended up essentially forcing Daniel to give up his track position and really affected his race.
Yeah, absolutely. And we saw Rosberg drop down. It was ninth after that first corner, which he ended up having to cut because he was forced off, and then was passed by Hülkenberg down into three, I think it was, or in any case before the end of the first lap, and then had it all to make up. And to briefly summarize his race, he had a puncture and that was sort of the end of it. He could only finish behind Max Verstappen in fifth place, and that's subsequently how we've come to a point where he holds only a 9-point championship lead, and that was Rosberg's race. But the fight at the front, that's the important thing, because Sebastian Vettel was leading, and suddenly we've seen, as we saw in Monaco with Red Bull Racing and as we saw in Australia with Ferrari actually, track position suddenly gives you an opportunity to watch, or what should be an opportunity, we should say, to dictate what happens in this race. But Ferrari opted for a two-stop strategy despite having, I suppose, the rare commodity, if you're not a Mercedes driver, of track position. And this is the second race in a row the leader has given up track position to Mercedes. Second time Ferrari's done it this year. Despite the fact, as you said, everyone knows the Mercedes car, whilst it's still very good in any conditions, lacks a little bit when it's having to follow another car.
Yeah.
I still can't figure out why they've done it.
I was expecting someone to have a gift bow on top of that and he'd say, here you go, take this. I was desperately looking for a position to be opened up online today for a new Ferrari strategist. I searched high and low. I could not find it. I honestly don't know what they're thinking sometimes. Let's understand that, okay, it was a virtual safety car. They didn't know it was going to end, or maybe they did know it was going to end. I doubt they did. Mm-hmm. On that lap, they pulled Seb in from the lead. Mm-hmm. And they put him on a tire that forced him to have another stop.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they were hoping for rain and maybe the great equalizer. I don't know. But I struggle to understand why you would want to give up the option of not having to stop again.
Mm-hmm.
You could easily have put on the softs and gone for the super softs later if you felt that you had to. But going with the super softs first, you're handcuffed.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's worth pointing out here a little twist in the Pirelli rules here. Normally they bring three compounds to every race, and two of those compounds, I guess we can call the prime tire, in which you have to use one of them in the race. It caught a couple of people out, not the teams. They know they're on top of these sort of things. But the fact that it wasn't two compounds in Canada, it was just two soft tires, which meant that when you might have originally thought that by Vettel using one of the harder tires, he didn't have to make another stop. No, you had to use the soft tire, and as a result, it was the dominant tire of the race because most people at least attempted to get past on a one stop. But after Vettel stopped on lap 11, I mean, it was obvious what Hamilton was going to do, and in fact, he said as much. Once they started the race, the team said, move to plan B. He didn't know what plan B was. In the end, it was a single stop race. But even when Vettel was on the super soft, which you could say is an alternative strategy, you know, it should be a bit faster than the soft, his pace over Hamilton on used ultra softs just wasn't that quick, was it?
No, I don't think there was much of a difference in speed in the compound itself. We also saw the ultra soft lasting, I think the longest stint was three laps longer than the super softs.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you have to wonder what the strategists were thinking, unless of course, as you mentioned at the start, the data from the Friday session, you know, wasn't really relevant because of the changeable weather.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to emphasize that weather point, it was only 13 degrees, I think it was, on race day, which is pretty chilly, and 24 was the maximum track temperature on the day, so wasn't as representative as you think. But nonetheless, I mean, it's what Lewis said in Monaco, and granted, Monaco is a unique circuit, but then the ultrasoft's only really being brought to sort of unusual circuits or circuits, you know, not standard, that the ultrasoft's essentially a super soft with purple painted on it. It makes you wonder perhaps if maybe the expectation was that everyone wanted a qualifying tire that would go off after three laps, and maybe Pirelli hasn't quite delivered what that is. They've delivered a very competent tire. It's ironic that everyone's saying they last too long when normally they complain that it doesn't last long enough. But it's an interesting situation now with this fifth compound.
Yeah, absolutely. I still wonder whether it's worth all the shipping costs and logistics to lug all these tires around. You mentioned the weather. Did you happen to catch what Jenson Button said before the race? He said it was freezing. He was trying to stay warm.
Mm, yeah.
Wasn't it nice of Honda to oblige and provide a little fire to keep him warm? What lap was that?
I think that would have been...
It was around lap 11.
Yeah, that was the virtual safety car that prompted the strategic disaster for Ferrari. I'm not sure he's complaining about the cold after that. No, I think you might be right. So we saw Vettel take that first stop. It was a very early stop indeed. I think that even Ferrari admitted it was probably slightly earlier than they anticipated, and very few people stopped quite that early. Only NASA stopped earlier than that, but you know, that's Sauber, and they finished well down the order. And I guess the idea would be that perhaps the soft tyre might not last what was nearly 50 laps that Hamilton was going to demand of them when he stopped on lap 24. Although, to be fair, that's exactly the window Pirelli predicted. I think they predicted 25 would be your ideal one-stop window. So it almost makes you, and even the way Hamilton talked after the race, where he was a man of serenity and calmness, I wonder whether he actually did feel under stress at all by the Ferrari behind him.
I think he might have felt that he had pace in hand to deal with, to manage the gap. And, you know, being in front still means you have to defend. And we saw how well Max Verstappen did at defending Rosberg. So, you know, you can make that car as wide as you want to make it. The only real challenge is along those straights. If you happen to have a little more grunt under DRS, you definitely have an advantage. But otherwise, you know, you can make that car rather wide. So I think Hamilton felt confident in both his abilities and perhaps the car and its pace to stay ahead of Sebastian.
And certainly, I mean, this is a circuit Hamilton knows well. He's the second on the all-time win tally here with 5 victories, a second only to Michael Schumacher on 7. So he does know what he's doing around this circuit, but it just must be frustrating. I mean, it's frustrating, I can only assume, for Ferrari, who's done this a couple of times this year. But it's certainly frustrating for anyone who's watching the sport, and even the sport itself, who's, of course, hoping for, you know, a big show and a spectacle every round, that these opportunities appear to be gifted to the team that aren't Mercedes, and they just consistently can't do it. And I wonder how much of this is whether they're trying to outsmart themselves or whether it is a lack of confidence in their own cars, because the one thing Mercedes has showed through all of those races where it dramatically lost the upper hand, if momentarily, is that they know exactly what they can get out of their car, and they nail those decisions every time.
See, when you're on the back foot, you try to get more pace out of the car, which inevitably means giving up perhaps a little bit of that reliability or that feeling of security that you might have. Whereas when you're in front and everything seems to be working and going your way, it's less of a concern. So part of it, I think you've nailed it, is that the fact that they may be trying to outsmart themselves to think that maybe they don't have what it takes to beat them, and therefore trying to make a strategic call to get the upper hand. Whereas others may feel that the pace of the car just isn't there, and they're maybe not so sure of what they can actually coax out of the vehicle.
Yeah, absolutely. But that was the finishing result. It was Lewis Hamilton who outwitted, if you will, Sebastian Vettel. Sebastian Vettel perhaps showing a little bit of that pressure towards the end of the race, where he had a couple of critical lockups that really sealed the result in the end. When he was slowly inching towards Lewis Hamilton, I think he got it down to 4-point-something seconds. A couple of critical lockups, which I suppose we also saw in Australia, didn't we? This race really does parallel Australia in some respects, because we had to see Vettel dashing for an unlikely position towards the end of the race and then making a mistake. He seemed very calm after the race, but we have seen perhaps a little bit more of a frantic side of him in the last couple of Grand Prix.
Oh, I think we can blame the seagulls for one of those lockups. I have to say that the circuit itself is rather harsh on brakes. I think there's four braking zones where the cars are braking from over 300 kilometers an hour. And if it's hot, you cook the brakes and they fade. And if it's cold, they'll glaze. There's very little movement or travel in the actual brake pedal. I think it's millimeters. So, you know, it is a very delicate skill that's required around Circuit de Gilles Villeneuve in terms of brakes. But I think the frustration might be, you know, he might have just been trying too hard. He knows he could have had a victory. He was probably frustrated a little to say that he may have missed his opportunity, and he might have, you know, he might have smelled blood. He might have said, hey, maybe I can do this. And pushed a little too hard. And we know what happens when you get a little too excited. You know, things happen.
You're Nico Rosberg. You end up on the marbles. You spin your car at the last chicane. A little bit too excited.
It happens.
It does happen. They were the top two finishing places, but Valtteri Bottas should not be understated in third. He's second consecutive third place in Canada, which is some result considering the Williams car has been a little bit out of sorts this season. I think it's fair to say that some of the bigger teams have been able to outspend the Williams team in terms of development. But he did so on that one-stop strategy, which again Pirelli did say would be the favoured race. He stopped on lap 23 as well, which Pirelli said would be around about that ideal window for a stop. And I think what's becoming key for Williams, they're really excelling in all the things that they still have control over, all the things which isn't just about throwing as much money towards your wind tunnel as possible and bring as many parts as you can. And one of the particular things is the pit stop table. They've consistently, in fact, at every race this year, recorded the fastest pit stop time. This was their second fastest, a 2.11 seconds. Their fastest was China, which was a 2.1 flat. I mean, those things count so much, don't they? Those little differences that you can make to your race contribute to a result where all things going right, you can get Valtteri Bottas onto the podium.
Absolutely. I think, you know, do the one stop, you're saving yourself a delta of, what was it, 23 seconds or something like that. Mm. And that obviously is going to go a long way. But when you can steal, you know, 1 second or half a second in a pit stop, that could make the difference between whether you're on the podium or not, or whether you're in the points or not. So absolutely, well done to Williams. As you said, they may not have the chassis they've been known to have over the years. They still have the Mercedes power, so they, you know, obviously not struggling in that respect. But I think they do what they do well. And there's a lot of brilliant minds at Williams. I expect them to be in it, or at least fighting for points.
Yeah, absolutely. When 2017 rolls around, we do get that change of aerodynamic rules, at very least. They've already admitted that that's more or less where their focus is now, and perhaps we can see another resurgence and jump up the table as we did at the start of this current regulatory set. And we talk about pit stops and how they make the difference, and 1 second, half a second here can make all the difference. As you said, the pit stop delta was somewhere in the vicinity of 20-something seconds. It's a quickish stop in Canada. It's one of the quicker places, at very least. I do want to talk about Raikkonen very briefly, because he was also on the two-stop. He was out of sorts all weekend, though. For whatever reason, he just looked desperately unhappy, well off the pace in qualifying. In the race, he finished 63 seconds behind the lead, and that's something like 20-odd seconds behind Bottas. Again, we see that perhaps if Ferrari had even split its strategies, one thing if you wanted to gamble on two stops, but it's surprising that we didn't see Kimi Raikkonen, considering how out of the picture he was for the win, be put on an alternative strategy and maybe clean up some points somewhere else. Because we can see everyone between Bottas and Raikkonen, which was Verstappen and Rosberg, two-stopped. So a one-stop would have been ideal here.
Yeah, he stopped on the same lap that Vettel stopped for his first pit stop. He stopped four laps earlier for his second pit. So his third, his final stint was a little bit longer than Seb's. So tire-wise, let's say that they were pretty comparable in terms of age and number of laps, etc. I think the difference is Seb had a little bit more, let's say, clear air. Kimi might have ended up, I think, overusing his tires, maybe being too close to the trailing car, so the following the cars in front, and also having to defend from behind. So I don't know. He was not happy this weekend.
Yeah.
I suppose he's not a big fan of Heineken.
Well, I don't know. I mean, stories you hear about Raikkonen could be quite the opposite. But perhaps he is not. I think it's interesting. I mean, we saw, I guess, what is a somewhat rare decision from Mercedes to split their car's strategies. Yes, their prospects were perhaps different after the first lap when, as we said, Rosberg was all the way down in 10th and eventually recovered to finish 5th. But it's interesting that they would choose to not break with that convention of, you know, giving their drivers equal treatment and whatever, when Raikkonen himself seemed pretty out of the picture all weekend. And you just wonder, I mean, if the teams have really gotten to grips with the tyres thus far. I know they all said at the end of last season when we brought in these tyre regulations that, you know, after three rounds, everyone will be doing exactly the same thing because everyone will understand the rules. But it's a strange vein of conservatism that seems to be gripping some of the teams, that they just don't want to gamble on them.
Well, let's remember that they have to select what compounds they're bringing before and how many sets of each. And therefore, I don't know how much I'm assuming that the team has more of an input on that than the drivers do. So it's whatever the team decides to bring that will dictate what they can select from. And having said that, not knowing exactly what these compounds are going to deliver, especially the Ultrasoft, because they haven't done a full round, there's really no data to back it up until Friday. So it's really an unknown. I would agree with you in that if you're going to have the two drivers with an unknown element, why not split the strategy if you notice that one may not necessarily work. If you're taking a risk or if you're making a strategic call, at least have one that's safe.
I mean, it would make sense to you and I. I don't know how these people... They should just listen to the program. They get so many ideas. It makes so much sense. And briefly, I do want to touch on the Force India cars, because they've now got higher hopes than they had at the start of the season because they've brought this B-Spec package. And the B-Spec package does seem like a step forward, but they didn't quite get the result they wanted in Canada. Hülkenberg finished 8th, which he did fairly well to do. He was the first man one lap down, Perez 10th. Interestingly, again, and we don't know how much this plays into the idea of there being unknown tyres and the conditions being a little bit different to what they expected, but surprising to see they didn't attempt to put at least one of their drivers, probably Perez, on the one stop, given that tends to be their strength to draw out the length of those tyres.
Again, I have to agree in that I don't know why the strategists... We're not professionals. This is what they do for a living. So you would expect them to know better. But from a fan's standpoint, I would expect them to give it a shot. Now with the Force India, again, we know that they have some good Mercedes power behind them, and their chassis definitely seems to be working well on tighter tracks. Perhaps Canada is a little bit of an anomaly with the tarmac being what it is, very green, the weather conditions, perhaps the tires aren't able to turn on or switch on quickly enough for them to take advantage of it. But we definitely saw some good performances from Force India, and I do expect that in races to come, they will steal some points away from people and probably frustrate teams like Williams, Ferrari, and Red Bull if they get it right.
And from one unknown to another, I suppose, the next round is going to be in Baku, Azerbaijani capital. Officially, we must call it the European Grand Prix. If you're looking at Europe on a map, you might struggle to find it, but it's there, I promise. And it's a street circuit, but it's a street circuit with a little bit of a difference, isn't it? Because it's going to be the world's fastest street circuit, if we listen to Herman Tilke, the man who designed it. And that's going to be a massive challenge, really. Now, we've got the middle set of tyres that Pirelli will be bringing, probably because, as is the way with new circuits, they tend to play a little bit conservative in case something catastrophic were to happen when they get there. But this is really anyone's game, considering that, as we said at the top of the show, 9 points in the championship, we've got a bunch of teams competing, and a bunch of teams that seem to work well on street circuits, whether it be Force India or whether it be Mercedes versus Red Bull Racing. I mean, we're set up really nicely now for this middle third of the season to start at Baku. A lot of people are naysaying it, but I think it could actually be really interesting.
I think the circuit, look, we haven't been there yet, so let's give it a chance. Could prove for some really good racing. They say it's the fastest street circuit. I think Montreal is also a street circuit. I'd be curious to see how much faster it is. Look, safety is always going to be a concern, so conservative tire choices are probably a good idea. What better setup can there be for things tightening up and going to an absolutely unknown circuit where the closest anyone has been is on a simulator? Let's do this. Let's see how what kind of performance we get out of this, what kind of entertainment we get, and hopefully it'll be tight enough that we'll actually have some battles throughout the field.
Fingers crossed, certainly. I think it's going to be an exciting weekend, but we'll wait and see. I've said things that are incorrect before, so we'll just wait and see how it pans out. That's all for the next episode, of course. But that was the Canadian Grand Prix. Ernie, you can be found at the F1 Poet on Twitter, is that right?
That is correct.
Thank you so much for joining me. I hope you enjoyed the race, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
And that's all the time we have for this edition of the Strategy Report. And if you want to read more about the strategy of the Canadian Grand Prix, go to f1strategyreport.com and follow the links to the blog for Jack Leslie's write-up of all the action from Montreal. My name's Michael Laminato. You can find me at Michael Laminato on Twitter. And be sure to join me in just 1 week's time when we look back at the first ever race on the streets of Baku for Azerbaijan's European Grand Prix. We'll be right back.